sometimes it's like there's this there's this deep ocean where there's a kind of stillness, and on the surface of that, kind of the waves are rising, passing away, and the sky above it, the clouds are scudding past. And it's all kind of a bit irrelevant, really. And passes, arising and passing. But there are much deeper currents that remain untouched by that. We have a sense of authenticity that comes when those deep currents can be contacted. There's something that that speaks in a timeless way from that. I know when I was a musician that people would usually, they would often ask me, you know, what kind of music do you like? And I could never really answer it, because my likes or dislikes in music had nothing really to do with the forms or the genres of music, but it had to do with some kind of sense of authenticity. You can hear that in, say, the music of somebody like Leadbelly or the great blues musicians. You can hear it in someone like Bob Dylan. There's a kind of honesty there. You can hear it in Charlie Mingus. You can hear it in Astor Piazzolla. You can hear it in Stravinsky. You can hear it in many places, different kinds of music, different arenas. One place you usually can't hear it is on the top 40. And it's kind of curious, because I think that there's it's interesting if we reflect on that, like why actually there is that which is authentic and real, and yet most of us, most of the time, get sucked into what is inauthentic and what is patently false. Is that because we're simply, is that because most people in the world are simply stupid? They don't have discernment? Is it because notions of authenticity and inauthenticity and so on are just irreducibly relative, and it's just elitist and arbitrary of me to actually say that there is some kind of authenticity? Is that the case? Or is it the case that there's some kind of global conspiracy that's deliberately fobbing off these kind of horrible crap for us to distract us? Or whatever. But in any case, I think that there's clearly a parallel to be drawn with the spiritual realm as well. And not coincidentally, perhaps it's associated with music, and you see in a lot of the more kind of popular evangelical churches, you know, this kind of very happy clappy kind of music sing-along kind of Christianity, and sometimes that gets imported into Buddhism as well, and we have this rather distressingly revolting kind of happy clappy Buddhism as well. And I find it difficult, I confess. One of the difficult things I have to practice with is when you're attending an event like that and then afterwards people ask you, did you like it? And I have to try to avoid offending them and also try to avoid breaking the precepts at the same time. The Buddha, of course, as always, gave the best response to that kind of thing when he was sung the love song by Panchasika, who came down to attract his attention with his guitar and singing a love song about how his desire for the great, the gorgeous maiden Surya Vachasara or something was as keen as the desire of the arahants for the Dhamma. And the Buddha responded by saying, oh well, the sound of your lute did not overpower the sound of the voice, and the sound of the voice did not overpower the sound of the lute, which was quite a nice way of paying him a compliment without remarking on the actual propriety of the whole enterprise. So this kind of thing happens in Buddhism, and I have a kind of ambiguous, let us say, relationship with these things. Actually, my search for Buddhism, my movement towards it was, I guess, because after having played music for many years, and I was very kind of uncompromising, and you know, I'd be quite frank that I'd prefer to play music that I believed in, that had some authenticity for me, even if I was just playing on the street corner, which is what I did for many, many years, then I'd be much better off doing that rather than playing some kind of revolting Michael Jackson or something in a pub and getting good money for it. And so when I came to Buddhism, my path to Buddhism was, if you like, even beyond that or past that. It was like, well, you know, even the most authentic and meaningful kind of music is still kind of trapped in its own limitations and can't transcend that. And so my search for Dhamma was really sparked by the discovery that there was something which went far, far deeper. And so this is always what I was imagining and what I was after. Imagine my surprise and only to discover that these kind of Buddhist hymn songs which took me back quite a few years to my old patterns of liking, disliking, aversion and attachment and so on and so forth. There was an interesting passage I always remember in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. He's talking about the perception of quality in literature, and he said, this is like as a teacher talking to his students, and he told his students that there is this thing called quality in literature which I can't define, but which you know what it is. And I think there's something to that. And I think there's something to that which is applicable to Dhamma as well, that we can't actually pin down what's authentic about Dhamma, but we all know what it is. And one of the problems is that as soon as we start to identify that, as soon as we start to pin it down, it immediately opens itself up for exploitation and it will start to reify itself and degenerate. For example, in Thailand, you know, you had the forest tradition, which was this kind of very authentic tradition, and one of the characteristics of that was a return to doing things as the Buddha did it. So they, for example, would make the robes out of the natural dye in the same way that was done in the Buddha's time. They would dye the robes with the natural dye. But of course, as time went on, that colour robe, which is still the colour that we wear today, became identified with the forest tradition and then became a quick and easy way for any old monk to participate in the spiritual prestige of the forest tradition. So that these days, of course, the use of the robes, these colours, is very widespread in Thailand, and it's no longer indicative of the forest tradition or indicative of any kind of authenticity in practice or even interest in Buddhism. So this is always a problem. We want some authenticity, we want that realism, and yet there's nothing we can do, there's no thing that can pin that down for us. We can try to find that authenticity through textual research. We can try to say, okay, let's look at what the Buddha taught, let's look at the Pali texts. And so this was like, you know, a few generations of us, and this was still when I ordained, was still the thing, the Pali canon, that's it, this is the Buddha's words, let's base ourselves on that. But then of course you realize, well, the Pali canon itself is problematic, it's edited over a long period of time, and so on and so forth. So then we can say, okay, well, let's do some comparative study, let's look at the Pali, the Chinese, the Sanskrit, and so on, and let's find the authenticity in there. But then of course you find that, well, you end up staring at a computer screen for a long period of time, and you wonder, well, is this authentic? The Buddha wasn't, didn't the Buddha was, this is, we're trying to get to the Dhamma that the Buddha spoke, but the Buddha didn't get to that Dhamma by staring at a computer screen. And one could quite rightly question whether that's authentic. And so this is the problem. It seems that whatever road we want to go down, that it kind of twists, and we try our best to be real, and somehow it kind of always twists around, you know, like if the forest tradition has this reputation of being kind of very content and very simple and so on and so forth. But you know, the reality is that for many years, certainly in Thailand, that the forest tradition monasteries would get vast sums of money, far more than the city or the town monasteries in the same district. And often we find that the forest monks, for example, the Western forest monks, are almost exclusively in Thailand engaged with the very upper crust of society. And I was speaking with Venerable Dhammananda the other day about this, and she was saying that when the Western monks and nuns come from England, that they almost always speak only with those people in the very upper class of society. And I think this is something we should be concerned about. I actually scolded Ajahn Brahm for that this morning, and I was talking with him. I said he's going to Thailand in next week, and he said, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm giving this retreat for this executive retreat in this 5-star resort or something. I said, Ajahn, you've lost touch with the common folk. You're losing it. He said, yeah, I'm not interested in the Hopa Loi anymore. So it's very important to be aware of that. I mean, there's nothing wrong, of course there's nothing wrong with teaching people wherever they are. So if you teach, you know, executives or whatever, that's fine. It's not a problem, and sometimes it's good because that has a certain symbolic value and other people tend to follow along with that. So it may be useful in that way. So there's nothing wrong with doing that, but it's important to also to recognize when the tradition as a whole is moving exclusively in that direction. Then that becomes a bit problematic. So how do we keep that? How do we keep that realism about things? Yeah, that kind of authenticity about it. So I mean, some of that comes from very simple things, and like just doing physical work. I think is very good. I'm quite cognizant of the fact that I do not nearly enough of that, certainly compared to when I was first here. And but it's a really good thing, just to realize that here in a forest monastery, that it's land, it's physical. There's this kind of earth stuff, and that's part of our Dhamma practice as well. All the trees, the leaves, we've been working the last few weeks in burning things off. And this is not merely just a chore which, just happens to have to be done, but it's actually an essential part of what we are. We're forest tradition. We're here living in the forest, this physical domain. Yeah, we wake up in the morning. It's very, very important to remember this. So to me, this is a really important part of my identity, as I'm a forest monk. And when I wake up in the morning, I don't see a flashing light saying Theravada. I don't see a light saying even Thai tradition. I don't see a light even saying Buddhism. Well, I look out my window and I see trees. And I walk from my kuti to the main building here, and there's mud under my feet. And this is what forest tradition is about. It's about mud, and it's about walking through the rain, and it's about being cold in the morning. And so that physicality of the forest tradition is very, very important, and something we should cherish, not to let ourselves and our sangha become something which is dislocated from the physical realm. And this can happen, and for example, so I've heard in the sangha in Sri Lanka, a lot of the time it's considered not proper for monks to do physical work, so they have like people coming in and doing all the cleaning and so on and so forth. So the monks basically don't do any physical work at all. I think that's very sad and quite disturbing, actually. And certainly not true in the forest tradition in Thailand, where the monks will always be doing quite a lot of hard physical work. And of course, they always whinge about it, right? That's part of it, right? You've got to work and you've got to whinge about it, right? That's the two aspects, yeah? Ah, I should really be meditating. I didn't become a monk to carry rocks or to, dig this piece of dirt or to whatever I'm doing. I became a monk to meditate. That's what it's about. But that's not what it's about, yeah? It's not about dust. The Buddha never said, just do meditation and never do anything else. And in the sutta we just recited, the Akankheya Sutta, he said if a bhikkhu wishes to realize all of these good qualities from the practice of Dhamma, then he should first of all sila svevasa paripurikari. He should be one who fulfills his sila. Okay, fulfills his precepts. And of course, fulfilling the sila, part of that means the sila of restraint is not breaking your rules. And it's a bit unfortunate that sometimes, especially in Theravada, that we have this idea that sila means not breaking rules, which is a very inadequate representation of what our ethical life is presented to by Buddhism. But another aspect of that is doing our duty, doing what is good, helping each other. And that means doing our work in the monastery, doing that with a sense of joy and a sense of devotion. Yeah, remembering that, just as the monastery is dependent on our theoretical understanding of Dhamma, it's dependent on our meditation practice, but it's also dependent on wheelbarrows, dependent on jackhammers, and it's dependent on the people who've offered those things. These are just as much a part of the monastery, not to mention cappuccino machines, of course. An essential aspect of any forest monastery, and certainly one of the more authentic aspects of Buddha factors. But (clears throat) So, you know, there's this kind of Marxist critique of religions. It says basically religions are exploiting the masses, and that they just sort of, you know, fob off all of these lies to the people so that they can get lots of wealth, and so on and so forth. And that critique has been applied to Buddhism with, one has to admit, with a certain degree of validity. It's not something which is, I think, ultimately true, but I think something which can be true in certain times and places. And we have to make sure that it's not true here. And we have to make sure that we actually do live in accordance with those values which the Buddha laid down, and that offerings are treated with respect, that we're very frugal and conservative in how we use requisites and the resources in the monastery, and that we're very appreciative of the fact that we only live on the excess, the surplus of others, okay, what's beyond their needs. And for a lot of people, they don't have a lot that's beyond their needs. Some people do, of course, but a lot of people don't. So this is this kind of physical aspect of our Dhamma and our Dhamma practice. There's another aspect which is also something we neglect to a certain degree, and that's it's also I'm very interested in the kind of sometimes the more primitive aspects of our minds and our practice, and one of the things we tend to neglect sometimes is associated with, like, that first thing, the physical thing I was talking about, is kind of associated with the first khanda, rupa khanda, is the physical realm, material realm, and how that is part of our practice and so on. And then the second part is like associated with the vedana khanda, is the feelings or but I'm not using it necessarily in a particularly technical or precise way here, but also I think vedana is associated in, it's almost like our kind of animal nature is one of the ways I think about it. And vedana is fear, irrational fear sometimes, fight or flight. We get overwhelmed with emotions, we get overwhelmed with anger, frustration. Sometimes the opposite, sometimes we get overwhelmed with desire or lust, and all of these kinds of things. So this is a kind of fairly kind of basic level of emotions which are largely shared in common with our four-legged friends, instincts. We see somebody, and it's very interesting that in psychology, the way that these things have been tested, that sometimes, you know, you see somebody and you make an assessment about them very, very quickly, and those assessments can be extremely accurate just on a very quick moment's association. Some of the tests that have been done were quite interesting. For example, they tested men and women's reaction to each other. And so, for example, they asked a bunch of men and a bunch of women whether they're interested in casual sex or whether they're interested in a long-term relationship. And surprise, surprise, I know you'll be flabbergasted by this, but most of the blokes said they're interested in casual sex, and most of the women said that they were interested in a long-term relationship. And so that was hardly particularly illuminating. But the interesting part was that they asked each, and I can't remember what from the bloke's side exactly the results was, but they, from the women's side, they asked them to, they look at a picture of their face, the particular blokes who'd answered this, and to guess which one they were. So they had to guess whether the bloke had answered, just from looking at the picture, whether they'd answered that they were interested in casual sex or in a long-term relationship. And the interesting thing was that they actually guessed with quite a high degree of accuracy. So just from a glance, just from one photograph or something like that, they were able to actually tell not necessarily consciously, so they wouldn't necessarily normally think about that, but they're actually able to just intuit about whether they, what their attitudes in that regard were. So this is kind of very interesting. This is kind of a sign of how sophisticated sometimes our, these kinds of our responses or understanding of these kind of motivations is. But, and the important thing is that we have to remember that this realm, you know, as I'm talking about, you know, it's a very kind of animal realm. It is things which you can observe very easily in, you know, dogs or chooks or whatever it is, you know, as we share it in common with those things. So we have to accept it. We can't kind of deny it. There is a continuity there. Yeah? But our Dhamma practice is to understand it and to not be trapped in that. And firstly, not to be trapped in it ourselves, so that we don't go just under the sway of our instincts. Okay, that's all it is. It's just these kind of instincts and drives and chemicals moving around our body and all of these kinds of things. So we need to be able to control that and restrain that. And that's part of what it means to be human. It's part of what it means to be a member of human culture, is that one can restrain those things. And so in Buddhism and Buddhist practice, of course, there are many tools and so on which can help us to do that. And we're given various kinds of meditations. And so these meditations often like focus on the nature of the body or something like that. And so we can understand. And this is what we're getting attached to. This is what we're getting involved with or whatever. And we can see, okay, it's just bones and skin and all of those kinds of things. And so then that leads to a kind of a coolness. And so it's very important to recognize that kind of coolness doesn't come from a sense of aversion and rejection, but it comes, nor is it something which is only for monks and nuns to do. Because all of us need that. I mean, this is something that is a very, very powerful source of suffering in the world. I mean, if we're in the world, if we're married or we have a boyfriend or girlfriend or something like that, then, you know, of course, there's always somebody else. And there's always a pull outside of that relationship. And that's like a pull. That pull towards adultery is it's part of something which brings chaos and disorder into the kind of the social fabric. Yeah. And that in itself has a certain pleasure, so that the very fact, often the very transgressive nature of it, actually heightens the pleasure. There was one comment in a novel, I can't remember what it was, years ago I saw, and he was writing about it, and the character in the novel said something along the lines that the chief, the main purpose of getting married is to be able to enjoy the pleasure of adultery. That's the only reason you get married for. Because then you've got a certain spiciness to your love life. But, and that's very important to notice that the difference is, or the actual act of marriage as such is not a sexual thing. Marriage is in fact essentially a spiritual relationship where one enters into a relationship with a person and with a whole person, yeah? And that's why you have those rituals. That's why you have all of the symbolic associations and so on. That one's actually entering into a relationship with a person. You don't need to have a ritual in order to enter into a relationship with a set of genitals. Okay. So if you just want to have sex with somebody, you can do it like the dogs do, or the chooks do, or you can go and see a prostitute, or whatever, and there's no ritual that's involved. So that's not what a wedding is about. A wedding is about saying, I'm going to not relate to a person purely for sexual gratification, but I'm going to relate to a human being, to another person. So you can see in that way this is actually a stepping out of and a restraining of that, those kind of instincts and so on. So interesting also to see how that's done in terms of, I mentioned before, in terms of the five khandhas, the rupa khandha, the physical form, yeah, the body is what this stuff is based on, and then and the next level of sophistication is the Vedana, is a pleasure pain dynamic, which is always kind of pulling, which is shared with animals. And the next level of the khandhas is sanya, or perception, which is a more sophisticated aspect of the mind. And sanya, or perception, is very much associated with culture and the creation of human culture. And so one of the things that sanya does, like, for example, in the cultural institution of marriage, is that it sets up a set of rituals, a set of symbols, a set of images which enable us to sort of pull us out of our mere animal desire and come to a more mature and more sophisticated relationship. And so this is that kind of realm or that domain of sanya. And so this also is part of our Buddhist practice as well, and part of what it means to be in the monastery. We have a certain sanya we've adopted. So we have like they use the words like the nimitta is like a sign. So they're like the sign for us as Buddhist monastics. Of course, we have a robe, we have a shaven head, and so on and so forth. And so we we enter into, as it were, that symbol or that ideal of the renunciate life. And that's something which is very fraught, very challenging, because what sanya does, what perception does, is the literal meaning of it is to know things together, knowing together. And by knowing together, what it means is that it sees things in terms of a collective, a kind of communal knowing. And so by entering within that symbolic system of, or symbolic pattern of the monastics, we're somehow seen together with the Buddha, seen together with the great Arahant, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. And we, you know, it's a setup, isn't it? You know, we kind of buy into that, those projections, and we almost like invite other people to project these ideals of purity or wisdom or compassion or so on top of us. And of course we buy into that ourselves. It's not just a third party thing, but it's something we also experience from within ourselves. So very important that we should understand these things, that realm or that level of sanya is only just that much. What the advantage of that, the beauty of it, is that these symbols call us out. They call us to answer and respond to that ideal. That's the beauty of it. It's not so that we can hide behind the robe, hide behind our shaven heads. Well, those of us who haven't got around to shaving in the last couple of weeks, our heads should be shaven. But somehow it calls us to answer, to live up to that. And so as monastics, especially in the West, is that we tend to have a very, very idealized and unrealistic expectation for what monastic life is about and for what we are and what we can do and all of these kinds of things. And so it's very important that we have a sense of realism and a sense of balance in that. And all of us who've been around for, you know, even a few years would have seen this kind of pattern very, very often in the monastery. And it's very, very normal. People come and they're very idealistic and all of these things. And then after a few years, the idealism fades, the original inspiration dies off. And if there hasn't been any kind of platform built to sustain that, then one naturally will drift back into lay life. And there's also a strong feeling that we can be unworthy, because we feel like there's this ideal we should be up there, and the reality is that we're way, 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 way down there. And we feel that, oh, people are thinking we're so pure and so wonderful and that, and actually we're not. So, but it's important that that this our understanding of this be balanced. On the one hand, we can't get away from it. This is the point. You see, you can't, this realm what we're talking about of sanya, of symbol and perception and so on, it's not an optional extra. It's part of what it means to have a human culture. And if we aren't buying into one set of symbols, we're buying into another set of symbols. And even people who pretend to reject all the symbols, of course, end up buying into it just in a different set or using it in a different kind of way. So we can't avoid it. We just have to use it skillfully and use it with a sense of space and a sense of distance, a sense of balance. And then there's no problem. Yeah? So it's that level of sanya, which is like a collective identity, a communal identity. That's who we are as sangha, whether we're Buddhists or monastics or whatever kind of group we think of in terms of a group identity. Then that is mediated by that kind of level of the mind, or level of what we call perception. Now, to develop and go further than that, right? Rather than being just to think that, you know, our practice is simply adopting a set of external signs, okay? Then the next level of the sankhara is what we of the khandhas is what we call sankhara, and this means something like volition or will or intention. And Where sanya or perception is very much a collective thing, something we share in common, volition or will is much more individual, or individually orientated. So this is that stage where we are thinking about the Dhamma, where we are considering the truth, where we are reflecting about it, where we are forming our own personal intentions, aspirations, our own personal direction in practice. It's sankhara which gets us out of bed in the morning to meditate, okay? That's that kind of will, yeah? It's sankhara is like the energy or the force in our practice. Yeah? And one of the things that if we're able to develop this stage is that there'll be a certain kind of level of individuality, and that is also important and really essential for the health of ourselves as practitioners. We have to be able to be individuals. We're part of a community, and in that communal role we do things together. We bow at the same time, we wear the same kind of robes, we have a shared identity in that respect. But that shared identity does not mean, and should never mean, that we all believe the same things, that we all think the same way, that we all agree on the same ideas. We should not. And if we see a community where everybody is believing the same things, thinking the same way, and all of those things, then we say that's a cult. That's not comprised of mature individuals who are actually doing an authentic spiritual practice. That's comprised of unthinking morons, okay? Do not do that. I don't want to live with a bunch of morons, okay? I would much rather argue with you and disagree with you, okay? and have you argue with me and disagree with me than I would to live with a bunch of people that say yes Bhante, no Bhante, how high should I jump Bhante? Right? I find this loathsome and repugnant. Okay? It's really important that we be able to do this. We can't. It's not just a matter of saying, oh well, you know, we're living. It's not a matter of just kind of Western conditioning. Okay, that we say, you know, in the West we learn to, you know, have a more individualistic approach, whereas in the East they have a more communal approach. Yes, that's true. That's a cultural difference, and that affects the manner or the way in which these things are mediated. It might affect the emphasis or the particular manifestation of these things. But the actual reality is, as reflected in the five khandhas and in many other things, is that all of us have these two aspects. It's irreducible. We can't get away from that. There is something about us where we say, we make choice. We decide. And there's a certain freedom in that, and there's a power in that, and there's a strength in that. And so we have to have that confidence to be able to say, no, I choose. This is what I choose to do. And through our choices, we will control our destiny, and we will control our the outcome and the direction of our own spiritual development, rather than letting somebody else choose for us. It's that moment where we can say, I choose. I'm going to do it this way because I choose to do it that way. Yeah? And so we must have the confidence to be able to do that, and to not feel like one of the most pernicious kind of doctrines, which is sometimes put about in spiritual circles, is that, you know, basically just trust the form, trust the externals, and if you want to do anything that's against the form or different from it, then it's your defilement. Don't believe that. It's wrong. Let the alarm bells ring when you hear that kind of thing. Ding, 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 ding. Suppression, denial, cultish behavior. This is what that's starting. Don't believe in it. Did the Buddha ever do that? Can you find me a single example of where the Buddha said to anybody that, you know, the fact that you disagree with me is wrong because you're disagreeing? Of course he would agree or disagree with people on what they're saying, but he would discuss that with them in a mature and adult manner. And never did he say to them, you're wrong because you're disagreeing. And it's inherently wrong to disagree, and because of your defilement. The Buddha never spoke like that. So if we hear spiritual teachers teaching in this way, then this tells us that they have not mastered that particular level of development for themselves. They're still not confident in themselves as to their ability to make wise choices. And so they feel threatened by the fact that other people may make different choices. That's where this is coming from. Okay, so please don't treat this as if it's some kind of higher wisdom or anything like that. It's not. It's just coming from insecurity. And just as in each of these stages I've been talking about the khandhas, using it as in a kind of slightly unusual way of to talk about it as stages in development of practice or aspects of our life. And just as the perception, the use of sanya helps us to control and shape and culturize our animal instincts and arise out of the Vedana to sanya, and then our development of sankhara then helps us to develop a sense of personal responsibility and choice, you know, which we associate with our ethical life. Yeah? In the same way, the development of consciousness, or jnana, helps us to transcend the sankhara. The sankhara has the disadvantage, the problem with it, of course, is that it's an activity. That's what sankhara means. And so it's active. Because it's active, it's not peaceful. Sankhara tends to divide things up. It tends to analyze things. It tends to believe its own concepts. And Ankara likes to act upon things. It's an operator, it's a doer. And so because of all of these things, it remains limited and can't and it like disturbs a faculty of knowing. So in the higher development, the higher stages of practicing Buddhism, we talk about the development of vijnana, what the Buddha called the adhicitta, the higher mind. And so consciousness as awareness itself. So when we are practicing and developing this, this is not done in opposition to the body. Okay? It's done in supported by and based upon the body. When we sit down, we say, okay, now I want to develop higher consciousness. First thing that the Buddha said, well, the monk who was adhicitta manayutto, gone to the forest, to the root of the tree, to the empty place, sits down cross-legged, sets the body erect, and establishes mindfulness in front of him. So that physical groundedness in nature, on the ground, in the body, that is the basis and the starting point of meditation, not a sense of kind of removal and alienation from the body. And then when we start meditating, we're watching the breath, watching the physical manifestation of life moving in a flow and a dynamic in the body. And it's through there that we then develop, and our development of meditation can also be understood in terms of these five khandhas. So you have the physical form that's actually we pay attention to is the breath or whatever, then the feeling in terms of the pleasant, painful or neutral feelings that arise with that. It gives us kind of emotional response to that physical phenomenon. And then there's like a perception, which is like bringing a unified knowing to that breath. So there's like a continuity of that and a collectiveness. The sankhara here is the dedication and application to the meditation. So that we have the energy and persistence to keep applying ourselves to that. And when all of those things are in unity, then there's the consciousness, which starts out as ordinary awareness of the breath, and then that gradually becomes very refined and very purified. When a refined and purified mind manifests as a sense of bliss and light and clarity and space, that's what it feels like. Within that experience, then everything is there. Everything that we have invested into our spiritual practice is all there. It's all essential. It's all part of that. And when we realize the fruits of that, we have a beautiful meditation and we're sitting very quietly in our heart and just feeling that sense of peace and contentment, feeling that sense of here I am and nothing could be better than this. And with hearing the rain falling softly on the trees outside, the wind blowing very gently, and you're sitting there and nothing could be better than this sense of peace and oneness. Everything that we have done, our whole life, has been for this. Right here, we are touching the highest potential and possibility of what it can be for us to be us. everything is in there, and yet at the same time everything is gone. And of course this is the paradox of meditation and the experience of samadhi, is it's a fulfillment. And this is one thing my teacher Ajahn Mahachanchai said to me one time when I saw him, that he said, you know, you shouldn't understand emptiness as being nothing. Emptiness is actually a fulfillment. And so on the one hand, this kind of experience of meditation is a fulfillment. It's a perfection of everything, of all our spiritual life. And so in that sense, it's conditioned. It still can fall apart. It will fall apart if those other conditions break down. Then the meditation will fall apart. And yet it also is a level of emptiness, a very high level of emptiness, of being able to just drop so many things and let go of so many things. In that moment, there's nothing there. And so that's why it's the launching pad for the realization of awakening. And so of course the experience of nibbana, of penetration to the truth, is none of these things. None of these things I've been talking about. It's not, nibbana is not the five khandhas. It's the ending of all of those things. That the ending of all of those things that arises in the right way through the fulfillment, perfection and development of all of those things. If we don't develop all of these things and perfect them first, then any kind of feeling of emptiness, not self, cessation, whatever, this is all wrong. It's very dangerous. And I've seen this many times with people who are practicing, who have basically got nowhere in their practice, and are full of this kind of language and talk of enlightenment and stages of insight and all of these kinds of things. And it's all rubbish. And it's all coming from a sense of self, and it's all coming from a sense of aversion, and it's all coming from a point within themselves where there's not the fulfillment, the maturity and the development. And the difference, if you've seen somebody who's really developed, the difference is night and day. And one of the very characteristic differences, which is in my experience is always there. There may be some exceptions, but I don't know of any. One of the great differences is a sense of lightness. And if you see somebody who's really highly attained, there's this sense of utter joy and utter almost frivolous lightness to them, where they can switch from the most profound dhamma to the most to kind of levity and laughing and so on, just on a dime. And that sense of, it's almost because they're not carrying any weight with them, and they can switch so fast. And that sense of lightness that's being brought, you can hear that if you listen to Ajahn Chah's talks in the original, in the Thai. You can hear that coming through his voice, that he will talk, and sometimes he's very strong and sometimes very profound and all of these things, but in his voice there's this lightness there, which is always very uplifting. He doesn't have this sense of ponderousness and pompousness. Yeah? So this is one of that characteristics. So that's that quality of that kind of paradoxical, both fulfillment and also emptiness, which, you know, conceptually is a paradox, but in reality is not at all. So if we want to develop our practice, and we want to realize that sense of authenticity and reality in our practice, if we want to be real about it, yeah, we have to develop each of these stages, each of these aspects, as best we can, yeah, to fulfillment. And that's how we stop ourselves from becoming, from from losing it, from losing touch with that aspiration which drew us into the Dhamma in the first place. That's how we keep on coming back to that ground of reality, that ground of authenticity. So this is my little talk for you this evening. I hope that's been of some amusement for you. Does anyone have any comments or questions?
Okay. Eva. Before you started on the beautiful part of meditation, when you were on the dirty, it's not good, it's the earthy bit. You sort of forgot all about your 275 vineyard rules, which rather take care of all that part.
227.
But those rules are very, very firm and they cover everything. So you can't
not at all.
Go around being different.
You can't go around being different.
Yes, you know, and all like all those things that you were saying. You were hinting at.
I wasn't hinting at anything. Everything was entirely on the table, Eva. No, the vineyard rules don't cover everything. The vineyard rules cover certain kinds of things, and many, many things that they don't cover. So we have to be quite aware of the limitations. Any kind of set of rules is not going to be sufficient to tell us how to live our lives. Okay? The form of being a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni was laid down or was well established and well developed and practiced and very fruitful and all of those things long before there were any vinaya rules or parimokkha rules. So all the parimokkha rules do is provide a kind of a boundary which in certain respects will stop us from going in one direction or another. But they don't in any sense, and they never were meant to, give us a complete guide for our spiritual development at all.
My other question is a little bit cheeky, and don't get cross, but where is the authenticity in a heated floor in a forest monastery?
Where is the authenticity in a heated floor in a forest monastery? I don't know, you should ask Ajahn Kalyano that, or Ajahn Sumedho, or all the other monasteries that have heated floors, I guess. I think heated floors are good.
You don't think a heated floor is just a trifle luxurious and a little bit apart from monastic simplicity?
No.
What's the difference in a heated floor than a heater?
Well, a cottage, yes.
No.
Yes, it does. But they said it did.
To put in, I not to run.
I am. And the heater, when it breaks, is simple to see. But a heated floor, when it breaks, I should imagine would be quite complicated, having to lift the floor and do things.
That's true, Eva. If there is some problem with the pipes in the floor, then it gets a little bit complicated. Although if it's a heated floor with wood on top of it, as ours will be, it's not so difficult because the wood can be lifted up in sections. But the Pat is quite correct to say that the heated floor actually is much more efficient in the long term because the heat's being delivered to where people are, and so this particular room. It's very high ceiling, so if you have any room with a high ceiling, then the heat will immediately escape and go up to the top. And so it basically becomes almost impossible to heat. You have to use a huge amount of energy to heat a room with a high ceiling. Whereas if you have a heated floor, the heat is delivered at your tootsie toes, which are the cold bits, and so you can actually use much less energy in total.
But I'm the only one here.
Is
that
what you're going to do up here?
Is
that? I don't know.
Yeah, could we not discuss building plans?
I'm sorry, you're always right, and I don't know why I have to insist on saying something other.
Mm. Well, I really rejoice in hearing the dirt, I'm saying.
More dirty bits. Tash wants more dirty bits.
Thing, you know, we come from the dirt and we go back to the dirt, you know, in the sense that we will all one day be in a box rotting, or we'll be burnt and our ashes will be spread back on the dirt. And I think the beautiful thing with the forest tradition for me is at whatever level you choose to practice, whether it's a lay man or a lay woman, if your karma is such that you have the good fortune to become a monk or a nun, you can go into the forest and tune in with what is there. The forest doesn't deny anyone access. If you have the confidence in yourself to, you know, take, you know, the body and the mind and quieten down and be still and tune in, that's a beautiful thing. There's no discrimination in that. You are allowed, if you place yourself in that space, and nature will teach you bit by bit. And sometimes it seems that for you, as you said, you wake up in the morning in your kuti and you don't see a Theravadan sign out your window, thank goodness. You see trees, you know, and there's a real sense of authenticity in that. And I think sometimes that's very, very reliable. You know, you look outside, everything's changing. But for me, I do have a real sense of faith and confidence in the bush. And there is a sense of purity and beauty in that, that I feel allowed, I feel at one with it, and that's a lovely thing for all people, even lay people. You know, we find it very difficult sometimes to develop that confidence in ourselves to practice to the best of our ability and to trust the bush. We always think the trust is somewhere outside in a picture or a deity or this book or that book, but giving yourself the trust to go into the forest and just tune in. I mean, it's our birthright, you know, and then you choose at what level you want to practice. So we're so fortunate to have the bush in our practice. So thanks for talking about the dirt and the bush in the forest. That unites us, which is a beautiful thing.
And the higher mind path is nice too.
Today I was not very well, so I couldn't do very much, and so I was just lying on it on most of the day. And I don't usually have a sense of physical limitation, like I've done a lot of training and dance, and so I've done performances with injuries and just at the edge of physical exhaustion, and still find the energy to do it anyway. And I was kind of enjoying that limitation, even though my mind was quite energetic, just not being able, not doing very much physically. And it was very nice to be limited to the physical realm, like to be dictated to. Because it just never really benefits. So it's nice because it gives you like the dirt perspective, where you're not a person in a monastery or anybody following the rules, or just in a community or anything really. It's physical presence. I suppose my question is like you can always find the energy if you need it. So where's that energy come from, if it's not from the physical?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Yeah, that's saw Ajahn Dasara once, he was, had malaria. Really knocked out. So he sees it through for his monk, so he kind of sold it on and still gave his Dhamma talk that night. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess there must be some. there must be something physically there. There must be something you can squeeze out of the chemicals in your cells to be able to stay alive. But and sometimes our ability to sustain is quite extraordinary. But as you say, also it's quite a relief actually, just when you sort of come up against those kinds of limitations. This sort of happened when I was a young monk in Thailand, and so when I did my knees in and stuff like that, and then you realize, you know, you kind of, there's a point where you realize I'm never going to win the Mr. Bhikkhu competition, and you realize not even bother just sort of entering the competition, you know. It's just, you can't do it anymore. You just can't sit for endless hours and all of those things. So it gives you quite a bit of relief. I think it must be getting old. Is that right? What do our elders have to say about that? Is that part of the joys of getting old? Do you accept the limitations?
I don't
know
about
those. Pretty practical about that.
I don't know about those 62 in here. Because he always had that premise of that there's just no limit to the energy, I'm never going to buy into that.
Mm.
When you find you can't stand on one leg for too long, that's a little sad.
Is it?
Be a clap too.
That cramps your style, does it?
Well, it makes the toweling after a shower a little awkward.
Uh-huh. As well as certain yoga postures as well.
And I was wondering at the level of metta, if you can only give metta to people in the in either Vedana or through the body, you can't do it with the higher, you just mind.
What do you mean by that?
Or you have to have like a certain embodiment of it.
Uh-huh.
Either through sensation or like physically helping someone.
Uh-huh.
For it to help them. Like you can just stare and say, maybe they'd be happy.
Right.
Like if there's no other quality to it, then those other two qualities doesn't exist.
Right, yeah, it's pretty thin, yeah?
Is it thin or does it just not exist?
I think it's just thin. But like if you think of it in terms of the sankharas, you know, if you're just thinking may you be happy, which is a lot of what metta is in certainly in Theravada, then it's happening at the level of sankhara kanda, yeah, but you're not involving the whole gamut, yeah? So
it takes more effort to involve the other
realm? I think so, yeah. Yeah, it's a bit more integrated.
Did you get that email from
Juba? From
say, later
to Concord? Oh, yeah, that was
quite
interesting. Yeah. Can you tell everyone what was in it?
She said to say, later to Concord, the teacher in Burma, and she sent an email through her meditation center in Singapore to looking about the workshop she was doing in Burma helping people after the cyclone. She was basically saying that, you know, she spent her life mostly meditating. And especially in the last few years, she's been just meditating or helping people to meditate, and And now she was doing a lot of work helping people physically move after the cyclone, and she was saying how important it was, and it was the Bodhisattva path, and it's just very important.
Sangha.